Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
And he picks up the book and throws it at me. Honestly. And Norman's got, Norman, now come on. And yeah, but he doesn't get it. How come fly fishermen don't get it? And Norma looked at me and said, Norman, tell him what he's supposed to get. It is not a fly fishing story. It's a story about me trying to understand my brother through fly fishing.
That was Jack Dennis describing an interesting encounter with a river runs through it, Norman McLean. This is a big one today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. If you get a chance, head over to wetflyswing.com/live. That's LIVE to check out the next live podcast where we have going here. We're testing out some of these new live shows on Clubhouse right now. So check it out. Head over there and check in and send me a message if you need a little invite to get in there. Jack Dennis, a big time player in the history of fly fishing in the U.S., a Team USA coach, author of one of the all-time greatest selling fly tying books, and all-around fly fishing superstar is here to share his super, super famous story. We hear about his connection to Ted Williams, John Wooden, Jimmy Stewart, and many other big-time people along the way who have made a connection to fly fishing and to the world. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors. TurtleBox is the loudest, truly portable, waterproof Bluetooth speaker available. We believe in respecting the peace and beauty while on the water, but listening to great tunes before or after can be amazing. Why not fire up this podcast or a little music after a big day on the water? Head over to wetflyswing.com/turtlebox to get started today. Sawyer offers a full line of modern and traditional products for oarsmen, canoeists, kayakers, and paddlers from all genres, providing unsurpassed function, performance, and beauty. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Sawyer to grab your set today. That's Sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R, to get started right now. I really think you're going to love this one today. So without further ado, here is Jack Dennis.
How's it going, Jack?
It is a beautiful day here in North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that
you can't see me, but I've got Carolina blue on right now.
I love it.
I got to go to church in Chapel Hill, and in this town, you wear light blue.
Yes, yes, I know light blue, and we're going to talk probably if we have time today about it later because I'm a huge. I've always been a big basketball fan. Michael Jordan was my hero back when I was a kid, and I know yes. I know the North Carolina days very well. So is it still Michael Jordan? Does it still revolve around Michael Jordan there?
Yeah. You know, he's got a statue and all that stuff. But let me tell you something you may not know, that a Wyoming boy invented the jump shot. And it was in the Hall of Fame. And I got to play against him when I was 18 years old. He's famous. You can look it up. And the reason he did the jump shot is because his brother was bigger than him. Anyway, basketball is like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think what we're going to have to do with this, Jack, is, well, we'll have to see what you think, but I just know that there's no way we're going to even touch the surface. So we might, if we go well, maybe we can get you back on for another one to do a second half of this if we run out of time, because I love basketball. My dad played for in college ball, and ever since then, I've been kind of addicted to it. But let's talk fly fishing. Just let's take us back. Yeah. Take us back, because you've pretty much done it all. You know everybody. You've been with some of the most famous people in the world and all that stuff. So we'll dig into a little bit. Just tell me how you first got into fly fishing.
Oh, it's really simple. My grandfather took me up to Lewis Lake. I was lucky that my grandfather had a ranch he invested in. My family came to Jackson Hole as Philadelphians, buying and hiring people to be homesteaders.
Nice.
That was common among the wealthy people of the East to go to the West, hire a person, give them a job. And then when they became a homestead, you know, you got so many acres, 200 acres, I think, back there, and they built ranches that way. And my family came there. My grandfather invested in that, so he would come back. I accidentally got born in Jackson. I was supposed to be born in Long Beach. My father was flying for, he was a pilot for the movie companies for 20th Century Fox. And he flew Ernest Hemingway and Gary Cooper to Jackson. And Hemingway, and I confirmed this with Jack Hemingway, he even remembers the trips and had pictures of it. We went into Heart Lake, and if anybody knows the West, you have to hike 7-8 miles into Heart Lake with grizzly bears around, and you could drive in it in those days. And my father couldn't, in those days, the pilot didn't go with him, even though he was friends with him. And he met my grandfather, took him home to meet his daughter, and they lived in California in the wintertime, the Philippine Islands in the winter and the summer in Jackson, but they also had a place in California. Blah, blah, blah. Long story short, my father went back for a hunting trip. I got born in Jackson.
There you go.
And my grandfather took me to Lewis Lake, trolled a woolly worm, and I caught my first fish. Never saw it. You say, reel, don't reel. Reel, don't reel. And then I saw this big brown trout, and I was hooked forever.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like I mentioned, we've had a number of people that have had some pretty huge mentors. And I know you've mentored a lot of people. We've had, you know, folks like Jeff Currier and people around, you know, the fly fishing space that are big influences that have mentioned you as well. But, you know, when you look back on your whole life, you got your grandfather. I mean, is there one person or a couple people that really stick out that impacted you from the fly fishing space?
Oh, well, there's several, but the number one is came my second father was sports announcer Kurt Gowdy.
Yeah. Yeah, Kurt Gowdy, I have heard his name. I don't know the whole history. I know, I mean, obviously, right, the TV show is a big thing. Can you just tell us a brief little snippet on why that, you know, what made that him such a great mentor?
Well, first of all, I met him I was going to be a basketball announcer. I did college games when I was in college. Small college just happened to end up winning the National Collegiate Championship. Four guys on the team went to colleges. Two guys went to the NBA. One's in the Hall of Fame. And I was the play-by-play, so I thought, hey, I can get a job. I was in the reserves. I'd gone to military service for 2 years. I needed to stay next to Wyoming. And so I interviewed with Kurt Gowdy for a job in one of his radio stations. He made a lot of money on buying radio stations.
Oh, okay.
And he was a very good businessman. But he's the only announcer. He's probably the great, and I've visited all of his, he's in all the, I think, six Hall of Fames, including baseball. But he was, in 1 year, he did the Super Bowl, the Bing Crosby tournament. He did the NBA championships. He did the World Series. He did the Super Bowl.
Wow.
And he worked for three different networks. And then he started the American Sportsman. Actually, American Sportsman was started, and the guy that was doing it became the NFL commissioner. And so Kurt was given the job, and he did fabulous with it. It lasted for a long time.
Yeah.
And in 1968, he invited me on the show. I was only 21 years old, and we did a show, which turned out to be the number one viewed show on American sports wow. in the 20-year history. But we had a very close relationship. We fished together. Yeah, we started he really kind of started the idea of the one fly. Lee Wolf, his pal, had written an article in Outdoor Life about if you only had one fly, what would it be? And Kirk picked the Muddler Minnow. Amazingly enough, Lee Wolf picked my Royal Humpy, which was on my first book.
Uh-huh.
And he just thought it. He was a dry fly man. People don't realize. He said, if we can't get him up to a dry, to hell with it. Now, I know yours is a wet fly thing, but he was actually known to use nymphs, and I was with him when he and Joan used nymphs under an indicator. But, you know, the Eastern Janda in the 60s started heading towards dry flies.
And
yeah. Before dry flies were, you know, hackle wasn't that good.
Yeah.
I mean, this is as big a science. Fly fishing is hard, really hard. And to be really good at it, the Mike Lawsons, the Randall Coppins, I'm telling you, I have all my kids are either medical doctors or PhDs. And I'll tell you, to know fly fishing in and out, when you get to that point, you have not one but three PhDs.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, Mike Lawson is a prime example of somebody who wrote a book, and Gary LaFontaine, all were people that were so brilliant, and they're just right up, but it doesn't mean anything. It's not that important.
Right.
As I have one doctor say, you're not saving anybody's life. Well, then Project Healing Waters came around, and we started saving soldiers' lives. So, you know, there we are.
Yeah. I think that's the power of the fly fishing spaces that obviously we all love it because it's fly fishing and stuff. But, and you've noted this, I think the one fly, right? I mean, you know, conservation is a huge backdrop. You know, most people that get into fly fishing eventually really get into conservation as well, or at least, you know, support it. And right. I mean, that's a big part of, do you feel like that's a big contribution that fly fishing gives to the world?
Well, I think it, you know, it's highly educated. The person that gets into it, usually if you look at the type of people that have been in it, from presidents to some of the most famous writers, it's intelligent, and it's intelligent to be a conservationist. And what we started the One Fly was Kurt's idea, because he had been in the one-shot antelope hunt. And so you imagine, this is 1973. We're going down the river. The number one voice in the country is announcing a contest between Jack Dennis and Kurt Gowdy. And Kurt had a wonderful singing voice. He could sing the national anthem. He could sing everything. And it was like two boys playing. And he'd say, well, Dennis makes a cast over there, a little bit short. Gowdy's coming back, though. And I said, Howard, you go to Howard. He was great friends with Howard Cosell.
Oh, wow.
And he'd go back and he'd go, well, Howard, what do you think? And he'd imitate Howard's voice. And we got done. I'd beat him. Rowing into the landing, I caught a fish in the middle of the river. And he never, ever got over that. He was a competitor. He was on the Wyoming team that won the national championship, the only time they ever did in basketball. And so he was definitely one of those competitors in fishing. And, you know, the first guy says, hey, I tenor on the big fish, you know, yeah, that type of thing.
Yeah.
The competitiveness. And, you know, that led to quite a bit for me. I started doing the NCAA coaches clinics to teach them fly fishing, to kind of lower the stress level.
Huh.
And Bobby Knight and Denny Crum and some of the ones that are still on it took the class. Denny Crum was the most natural caster that I've ever had. Within one lesson, he was casting 80 feet. And he says, I love this fly fishing.
Who did he coach? I can't remember. Denny Crum.
At Louisville.
Oh, Louisville. And then, that's right. And then, of course, Bobby... Yeah,
he played. He was from Los Angeles. He played for Wooden.
Oh wow!
And then poached under Wooden.
Oh, that explains it.
And he had wonderful stories, and we still, he's about 82, three. He's had a couple strokes. I got him coming to Jackson, and he met Mike Lawson, and he bought a place on Henry's Lake, and we used to fish the canyon. He was a big card player, poker.
Yeah.
And we go to the room, and he says, "I'm gonna get on the computer, and I'll pay for the trip." He came out. He's won $800. Let's go.
Nice.
Yeah, and we just had some wonderful times together. And then he and Bobby Knight and Gary Cunningham, all students of Wooden, gave me in a ceremony. It was a ceremony of the Pyramid of Success, where he signs it and gives you a little note. And it means that you understand the values of coaching. And what people don't realize, he won 9 national championships, which nobody's ever done, and many in a row. And he never once ever told any of his players to win.
Nope. Practice.
He told them to play as best, and if you don't make mistakes, you're not going to be a good player. And he didn't believe in the individual player. He believed in it as a team. Okay. Anyway, that's what basketball is, the same kind of discipline.
No, I love it. I love it. And I'll make note. You mentioned Mike Lawson. We had him on the podcast recently. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. And
Mike is, we've known her since the early 70s.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Mike was great. It was great to talk to him. And then Wooden, I just want to touch on that quickly because I think it does apply, right? Because John Wooden, I can't think of a bigger person who I'd love to learn, who I'd love to have as my coach. But what could somebody take, listen to this, if they're fly fishing, they're trying to get better at fly fishing, what did Wooden teach that we might take away from that?
Well, I think I have a better teacher for fly fishing than Wooden. Wooden is a team guy.
Yeah.
Even though, let me just say this about Wooden. One of the most important thing about Wooden is that you did everything, as a team. But, one of the things was, don't be afraid to fail.
Yeah.
And that in fly fishing important. But I think more than anything, Ted Williams probably said the best about how you get good.
Yeah.
And I was lucky to be with him when Kurt Gowdy did the National Sporting Goods Association meeting. It used to be a big thing. All the sporting goods dealers went to Chicago. This was 1977, and he wanted to learn how to tie flies. So Kurt set it up. We were in a hotel together, and I taught him how to tie flies. He had owned a business called Worldwide Sportsman with another guy by the name of Billy Pate and George Hommel, and it was a guiding operation, a small operation, and he wanted to learn how to tie saltwater flies. He had a lot of money from Sears endorsements, but he was sort of cheap. He didn't want to have to buy flies. They wanted to learn to tie them.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, the important thing I learned from him is, how do you get great? And it all started out with this. My father was a pilot for the Kansas City Athletics in the late 50s. And I went to his last game in 59 at KC Stadium. And it was the last time he was going to play there. And my father had to get there because the owner wanted him there early in case he had to fly somebody out. He didn't trust anybody in Kansas City, which is why he moved to Oakland with the Athletic. So he'd fly him to Chicago where he was from. So Dad had to be there early. Here Ted Williams was out there with a bucket of balls. The guy was throwing it to him, and he was hitting them over the fence, and I counted it, 13 in a row.
Jeez.
So I told him about that. Oh, he says, that's a game we used to play. My best was 19 in a row. I always wanted to get to 21, or something about 21.
Wow.
And I said, well, Ted, come on.
That's crazy.
He's just lobbing you the balls in there. He says, no, he's not. I pay him $5 for every ball he throws by me. Now, $5 in 1959, like a $100 bill. So But he said, here's what you do. You practice until you're tired of practice, and you practice some more until it becomes automatic and you can think of the prettiest girl in your life, or if you're a woman, the prettiest guy or whatever anymore. Yeah. I don't know. But you could think of whatever you're doing and it all comes automatic. Yeah. And I think the most important thing you can learn is to try to fish harder waters, like basketball, play a better team. You learn from somebody better. But number one is observation. I was just giving a casting lesson. My wife said, you know what? Watch your husband. He said, see how he does it? He says, yeah. So that's how I learned to cast. My husband couldn't tell me anything. I learned by watching him. Mm-hmm. So I think observation, the casting is the key to everything. Hmm. You can read all the books. You can learn all the techniques. If you can't deliver, that doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about casting. Sorry. Now you can fish little small streams or cast. You're not going to have to do a roll cast, and you can get pretty good at that. It's sort of like being a pretty good little league player, then a pretty good high school player. And as you get up, it gets harder. The same thing. When you go to the Henry Fork, I can't remember how many people who fish waters in the east, little streams, and realize they had to make a 40-foot cast.
Yeah, it's a decent.
And then fishing from a boat where you couldn't false cast.
Right.
You know, at the time you start false casting from a drifting boat, you're past where the fish rose.
Oh, right. Yep. One shot.
So, you know, and also, if you really want to get into it, I always get these kids. I tell you, I could make a living doctors hiring me to convince their sons not to be a fly fishing guide, to go back to school.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the pandemic kind of knocked that down.
Yeah.
But there isn't any better way to learn fly fishing than to be a guide. And another thing, go to a guiding school. Even if you're not guiding, you'll learn a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned earlier your first book. I kind of had a note here. Obviously, one book I remember, I think when I was a kid, obviously a long time ago, was your tying, your tying book. I'm not sure what was your first book, and can you talk about the one with the face on, right, with the face on?
Right,
on the cover?
That was our first book, which Lee Wolf just said it. The right thing. It says you gave it where you can see it in pictures. Pictures mean everything. Well, now, of course, video, and I was lucky to pioneer that. But every book I'd seen had like five pictures. And on the average fly, there was probably 20, anywhere from 12 to 20 steps. And so they'd just miss them. And I figured, well, why not do a book where you had every step? So, well, that's going to be really expensive. It used to cost $250 to put a black and white picture in a book. And so it was really expensive to produce a book. Well, anyway, I went and I still have the letter. I went to Digest Books. At that time was the number one book company for doing paperback books. We never envisioned it any more than a paperback. And it ended up being 300 and something pages, which was, you know, thickness. It was more like a textbook. And my banker, who was a fly fisherman, after I got turned down by them, he says, I don't know why you don't do it on your own. I said, what do you mean? I had no money, nothing. He says, well, I'll bankroll it. And so we did it. And it turned out to be the best-selling fly tying book in history. Over 400,000 copies.
What was the title again?
Jack Dennis Western Trout Fly Tying Manual.
That's it. Yep, the fly tying manual. And who is that photo of the person, the close up on the cover?
The close up's me.
Oh, that is you. Oh, wow, that is you. Okay, yeah.
I did the Royal Humpy like when I was 20 years old. The Humpy was the big fly then. No, and I had this guide friend of mine who was 50. He said, people can't see the Humpy. And he says, is there any way you can put a white wing on it? And so, obviously, with the Royal Wolf, I incorporated, called it a Royal Humpy, and put it on the front of the book.
Yeah.
And it became a pattern used worldwide.
Yep.
And then Randall Kaufman did his stimulator,
All right.
He called me up and says, can I copy your book? It won't be nearly as thick. And Amato Books is going to publish it. And I said, sure. And you're best friend. Go ahead and, you know, do it. And it was American Nipkong Manual.
Yeah, I love that.
And he didn't make any money. And I said, well, you know, I looked at it too and says, look, what? You make it $1 a book?
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And so what I did is said, Randall, here's what I did. And Randall did what I did and formed Western Fly Fisherman's Press and started to roll out books, which I did several of the forewords. And then I advised him on the Bonefish book, which is the Bonefish book in the world. He did a little paperback, and I threw it at him and said, come on, this isn't a book, it's a pamphlet. Interviewed bone fishermen, interview guides, they'll tell you how to fish.
Yeah.
And he did it, and he did really well. He did something I didn't do. He went off seas. I was too loyal, and I had my books all done here in the U.S. Right. I did a second one, and I revised it. It was a volume two, which brought flies in from around the world with my travels. And it completely sold out. That I don't even have. I have one copy left. And there's so many out there. When you sell a couple hundred thousand books, there's used copies. That's pretty much, you know, end of that. And then I did one, which was my favorite. I hired a guy to steamroll a beautiful writer. He was from Wisconsin, and that was Time Flies with Jack Dennis and Friends.
Yeah.
And I ended the books there. I don't enjoy writing. It's not fun, and you shouldn't do anything that isn't fun.
Yeah.
And then I started with a camera in 67 filming 8mm and then learning from the American Sportsman. And I built up a library, but there was no real market for it except for lectures. So I started doing lectures, and I would be the only one who would have movies. Everybody else had slides. And eventually, thanks to Gary Borger and 3M, they did a fly tying tape. And it was really well done, but it was done in a way I thought, if you were a left-hander, it was great because they shot it from the front.
Yeah.
But if you're the 70% of the country or more, I don't know what the percentage are, right-handed. So, you know, you go to your audience, as you know, as a podcast. So I devised a way to shoot from behind you, so you had the same view. And also 3M wouldn't pay me any money.
Yeah.
You know, I learned from the book business. And so I proceeded to start in 1986. I had a contract with the New Zealand government, and I'd met some photographers, and we did some filming because I wanted to do it during the spring. And obviously, the middle of the winter, you're not going to get fishing pictures. It was a good excuse to go to New Zealand and work. And so we did that, and then we followed up Mike Lawson. We did one with him, and then we did our classic, which is Caddisflies, which still sells. My God, the thing's almost 40 years old.
Oh, Caddisflies. Is that the one with LaFontaine?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's the classic.
We formed Traveling Fly Fisherman. We did a DVD on that, and that still sells. Has Gary's funeral. And
which one was that, the DVD you just mentioned?
Tips from the Traveling Fly Fisherman.
Okay.
And then we revised that to include Gary's funeral and his last words before he died. It's really a very poignant.
Oh, wow. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, so people can.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and I have. You can get it in. I sell. You can get 12 DVDs. There's no DVD market left. You get 12 DVDs for $2.
Yeah.
You know, it's just.
It's all streaming.
I do it because I want to educate people, and it gives me a little spending money. My wife has me on a strict. Since you're retired, don't retire. If you've been married for 50 years, they put you on a tight budget.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Sawyer offers a full line of modern and traditional products for oarsmen, canoeists, kayakers, surfers, and paddlers of all genres, providing unsurpassed function, performance, and beauty. They design and handcraft every product in the USA, ensuring everything they make is from the highest quality materials with careful attention to detail. They take pride in their employees' stewardship of the environment and our country. In return, you have the assurance of knowing the product you receive from them is genuine, made in America, and cannot be replicated. I've been using Sawyer products for a long time now, which is why I'm definitely excited to share them with you on the podcast here. I've been down some crazy technical whitewater and mini fishing adventures that put me in places that were where I had to make a good move. And I love the design, the power, the performance, and always knowing that I can count on that stroke, even when you need to make, you know, that one to get past the rock or whatever. You can always count on Sawyer for that. And you can count on them as well. Sawyer products are designed by paddlers, oarsmen, and surfers alike to fully meet your performance needs. Pick up one today and experience the feel of water. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Sawyer to grab your set today. That's Sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R, wetflyswing.com/Sawyer to get started.
Hey, I kind of interrupted you there. I wanted you to go back to that Gary LaFontaine. But before, I just want to note also that Gary Borger, we had a great episode. He did a little bit of the history on nymph fishing and stuff. And we talked a little bit about River Run Stuart, which we may not have time to dig into that today as well. I know you had a little bit of an impact getting that going as well. But finish that thought on Gary LaFontaine, because obviously Caddis Flies is huge, and I've had a few people talk about, you know, the impact of him and on fishing. But talk about that at his funeral.
Yeah, well, Gary and him were very similar. Both named Gary, and both were professors or teachers. Gary taught a little bit, and then he became a clinical psychologist for prison families in Deer Lodge, Montana, which is a pretty good place to live if you have to do that job. And he took it pretty seriously, but the job was where he could travel and do lectures, intermit the job. And it was a 20-year job, and then they retired you. Very stressful. And so Mike and Gary, we all weren't really that big on traveling alone. So we started to do sports shows together, and then we realized the intellect of Gary and his approach, which not necessarily matched everybody's approach, but it really matched in very intelligent people. He would say, well, 85% of the time this nymph would work doing it this way. And Mike would roll his eyes. And I was always in the neutral thing. Yeah, sounds good to me, Gary. You know, that's just me. But the friendship grew and grew, and we helped Mike complete Spring Creek books. Yeah. And Gary, on his deathbed, told Mike, this was like about the 11th year of trying to write this book, you will finish the book, which is brilliant.
Yep.
And that really had an impact. Mike got to take him on his home waters, the Henry's Fork, where he caught his last fish. I was with him when he got the diagnosis of ALS. And we went through a lot of hard times, DVD, we talk about, even though he couldn't fish, he never lost his enthusiasm, and he continued to teach. But his way of looking at a misunderstood insect who had really just given, you know, kind of a, they're there.
Yeah.
And he made them into a more important insect. The biggest problem being is that the insect, that once it emerges, it flies off. So you only have a very limited time you can catch them on the surface. And then they come back to lay their eggs. And so Gary looked at it under the water, since 90% of their time was under the water. That was part of it. And then he learned about the different ones. And I fished caddis in Australia with him, in New Zealand. No matter where you were, caddis were caddis. They were everywhere, especially in Europe. And so Gary brought us to that point where we started looking at all insects differently. Gary Borger wrote about it. Gary did it more like if you were a student, you'd be fine.
Yeah.
Gary said if you were a scientist, you'd be fine. And then we started taking it to the average guy, and they got it. And that's what video would do. A guy would sit down and watch a two-hour video where he had a tough time reading Caddisfly's book, which was about 3 inches wide.
You know, Jack, this is this conversation. I think about this, you know, that we're talking about a lot of writing. I've interviewed a lot of editors and, you know, I've had like John Gearock, lots of great writers on the show. For me, I kind of struggle a little bit with writing. It sounds like maybe similar to you, or you don't enjoy it. And I don't as well. I've always loved the audio, the video a lot more. I'm curious, you know, with you, do you think if you would have wrote more that, you know, maybe you would have enjoyed it, or do you feel good? I just like for my own experience, it seems like I feel good. If you could make a life in fly fishing without being a big writer, writing articles, then, you know, you can do it, right?
Well, first of all, you got to really look at it and understand. I tell everybody, you have to have another job.
Yeah.
There are very few people that can ever make a living to support a family from guiding or tying flies or writing books, Gearock being the exception.
Who has done it? Who out there has done it just fly fishing over the years?
Well, there's been people make livings.
Yeah.
Gosh, Mike Mishak in the fly shop. I mean, livings, good livings. I made a good living. But I also had, I was paid to run our store. It was basically the name. And I hired people like Jeff Currier, who ran the shop for 27 years, the fly shop. And I had a general manager. I had the best. And I gave them a job. And it was their department, the shoe department, whatever. And the store made money. I went out and got publicity for it. And I got the money for the speaking engagements and the thing. And so when I added up, I did really well. Lefty and I compared. Lefty definitely made a good living, but he said, here we are making a living about what a first year lineman in the NFL. And they work 3 years and they get that for the rest of their life. He says, really aren't that big a deal.
No.
And Arnold Palmer told me that when I gave him a lesson, we opened a golf course. He says, how much do you get? This is 1985. And I told him we got anywhere from $500 to $1,250 a day. He goes, what is the best in it? And I said, well, gosh, yeah. And he says, where do you rank? Oh, somewhere in the middle of the top 10 or something like that, you know. And as I know, we never really rated that. And he says, well, the top guy, 500 to 1250. He looked at me and said, man, that's a really small field. He says, yeah. I get $50,000 to play a round of golf and they fuel my jet.
Yeah.
And I got, you know, I think you have to keep it in content. Yeah. We meet a lot of famous people. We do a lot of that. And it's a good living. Have a fly shop. You're going to work your ass off. You're not going to get to fish as much as you think you are. And you better have teaching services. You better have guide services. You better be in an area where there's good fishing, or you got to be special. But it's no more than a living. Now, if you look at Sage Rod, is owned by the Green Foundation, which owns the the Seattle Seahawks.
Yep.
Bill Ford of Ford Motor Company owns Scott.
Oh, wow.
A wealthy kid from Florida owns Thomas & Thomas. They've had like five owners in 25 years.
No kidding.
And TFO is owned by a well-to-do Texan who shares ownership with his employees. St. Croix was run by the same family, and that's still a family deal.
Yeah.
And
so is Orvis.
Yes, but they you got to understand about Orvis. They came from Cleveland, and the grandmother was the heir to the Cleveland porcelain foundry, one of the I think the third or fourth largest business in Ohio.
Yeah.
So when they walked in to Orvis, they had big time money behind them.
Yeah.
That's a whole story you could write a book, divorces, things. And by the way, this is one of the few companies that have done better than the people before them.
Oh, right.
The kids, the grandchildren of Lee Perkins, have done a magnificent job running it.
Yeah.
Did the Suns, but they ate one, kept doing better.
I've got Perk coming on soon on the podcast. I don't know the whole, I've had Tom Rosenbauer on. Don't get into that.
No, don't get into divorces and stuff.
No,
like that.
God, no, 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 no.
but he has a house in Jackson and they have property down in Afton.
Yeah, I want to hear the story of more of this, the Orvis kind of that. No, I don't want to hear about divorces. Yeah,
you don't get it in the, he's a very engaging personality. David was a real hard worker. You remember I had the Jackson on one fly. When that thing started in 1986, we got everybody.
Yeah.
You know, fishing field. And David was on several good foundations. The kids were good kids. And we really did a great job with their kids.
Yeah.
You know, I have nothing but great respect for Orvis.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I think I remember when I got started, I was kind of around some, you know, the local fly shop sort of thing back when I was young. And I remember Orvis was always the company we used. I didn't know the story, you know, about them, and it's a good one. But, hey, I wanted to get back, Jack, just on that writing again, because it's interesting to me because, like I said, I struggled with it. For you, you've written a couple books, right, but you don't enjoy it. Do you think what's your take on writing it? So it sounds like for you, you know, it wasn't important for you to make a kind of get to where you got. What would you tell somebody that's trying to, kind of, again, make a side business in fly fishing? Is it helpful to be a writer?
Well, first thing is do not leave your day job. Okay?
Yep.
Ernie Schwebert, who's well known, was an architect, did the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport in the U.S. Air Academy. He was set. Dave Whitlock was an artist for Phillips 66 in Oklahoma. Most of these people, Swisher was a chemical engineer, Borger a professor.
Yep.
All these guys had Mike Lawson ran the shop, sold it to Rockefeller.
That's right.
And then you've got, you know, you've got, I had the store. That was my second job. And so, you know, you got to be realistic. In the old days, the Bud Lillies and well, a lot of people don't realize that Dan Bailey was a nuclear engineer on the Manhattan Project. And he got so whacked out after it was done, he headed out west and just drove, and his car broke down in Livingston, and that's where he did his fly shop. my advice to the young person is fly fishing, since river runs through it, and since all this, will be oversaturated. There'll be way too many of everything. And the easiest way I tell them is what I just told you. $500 a day is the going fee today, 2021.
Yep.
In 1990, I was getting $750.
Roy.
Yeah, you tell me where this thing's going. So
wow.
Would you, if you had money, would you invest in that?
No, that's amazing. So in 30, I mean, yeah, basically in 30 years, the rate they're getting is essentially the same.
Not the guide. The speaker.
Gotcha. Yeah, the speaker.
But the guiding isn't any different.
Yeah.
Well, actually it was. It was about 200 then. The guiding now is about 600 a day.
Yeah, it's a little more.
500, right. 600 a day. And it's going to stay right at that because there's plenty of guides. You get a guiding shortage. But see, most of the guiding is controlled by the government. People don't realize that. If you didn't have the Forest Service and the National Park System and the BLM, they control about 80% of the guiding in the United States.
That's right.
So you're not going to get over-guided because they have limits on it. And places that don't have those regulations are just beat to a frazzle. And then, of course, now you have a lot of people with boats, which is great. If you know how to use them, know the etiquette. I mean, you know, you're not going to ever, unless you go, if you live in Boise or you live in a place where the river's right, you know, Jackson Hole, places where the river, you know, Moffin, Oregon, where you can just throw a boat in the river.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you're going to maybe fish enough to get good at it. But you also got to watch, never get above your level in competence.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. No, this is good. I think, like I said, Jack, I knew that we were going to struggle to get, you know, to get to some of the, I was thinking, you know, nipping, dry fly fishing, you know, just more on the actual fishing. I'm not even sure do you do more, you know, over your career, more nipping or dry fly fishing? You kind of did it all?
Well, I kind of did it all because I did the TV shows. So you got to realize that after, in about 1986, the One Fly started, and that was an idea to promote catch and release. We had 17 teams, and right off within an hour, my wife was the ER nurse that started out in 1973 before there were even ER doctors. And one of my friends who volunteered to guide him, because I said, look, we're going to pay guides. I'm not going to have, volunteers, no offense, I love volunteers. But if somebody's paid to do a job, they do the job.
Yep.
And it's better to pay somebody if they don't do the job. If you're a volunteer, I never forget when my friend says, hey, go tell Joe to do this. And I said, why don't you? He says, well, we're big buddies and we play cards together. No, I can't. So anyway, one of the guys volunteered. He was a California boy, guided. End up, quirk little deal where the boat got away from him. And he ran down the bank. The bank caved in. He fell in the water, broke his neck, and drowned. And that was the first 2 hours of the One Fly. I was there when the helicopter pulled his body out. My wife, of course, pronounced him, and the doctor pronounced him dead. So that's how the One Fly started. It evolved over a 35-year anniversary coming up. It evolved over putting the guy's two kids through college. And all have wonderful careers. And then it evolved into making money for streaming projects. And we just got through putting about a little over $300,000 into stream projects. Even though we didn't have a One Fly last year, our virtual auction made the kind of money that we needed to keep going. And we keep reserves. Definitely paid all the guides, by the way, too.
Yep.
Every guy got paid for last year, and this was, you know, so let's get down to a career in fly fishing. A career in fly fishing is keeping that job and taking the time, if you enjoy guiding, instead of going fishing, you guide, and you get your fishing through the guiding. It's very interesting when you have an illness, how it can change your life. Gary's, of course, was changed with ALS, but I got a Wuhan virus in 2012, a friend of mine was running a factory to tie saltwater flies in Wuhan, and we were doing the New Mexico conclave. It was getting in about the end to where I was quitting doing lectures. It was just getting tough and not making any money like you used to. We met, he hugged, gave me a virus from Wuhan. I ended up 2 weeks in the hospital, $300,000 later.
Jeez.
Heart condition, all the stuff that happened with COVID. I lost a sense of smell, which I never got back, but I didn't lose my sense of taste. AFib, a life of now Eliquis, and it came back 3 years ago. And then, so when I see this thing happening, it wasn't the same virus,
yeah,
but it had the same effects. So I do it. And so I said, you know what? This is a time. So I started, my doctor, a wonderful doctor who's the one that diagnosed it finally after it. And he still don't know what the virus was, but he said, told me I was going to have a heart transplant. And bottom line is the heart shrank back down. And to just quickly say, I thought, what could I do? And he says, you know, you need exercise. You can guide me. So I went back to guiding and I did it for foundations to make them money. And, I did that for 10 years. And I put the money into Project Healing Waters, Henry Schwartz Foundation, Utah Trout, Colorado Trout Unlimited. I got a little extra money out of it, but they made money, you know, kind of what retail was all about. And I got to fish through all the people. And the nice thing is I could pick. I knew who was coming. I knew their strengths and I made them better. It was like coaching an NBA team. It was wonderful. And I went fishing with Randall Kopp, and that was the only people we went over. We were the last people. We get these wonderful distinctions. We were Randall and Mike Stidham, who and a friend of mine, Tom Doxey. We fished Monster Lake the day that Kanye West bought it in Cody, Wyoming. And we were the last people to fish that lake commercially. Kanye took it over, and then with the pandemic, it has laid dormant. Okay. Unbelievable place. If it ever opens back up, I hear Kanye's getting a divorce. Who the hell knows what's going to happen? But if you get a chance, you go to Monster Lake, because it is a great place to get a trophy tiger trout.
Oh, right, right.
And on dry flies.
Yeah.
Now, getting back to dry flies.
Yeah.
On that 10 years, I floated the New Fork and Green River out of Pinedale. I'd rent a condo every year and go there. Last year, my grandson helped me drive in the car, vehicles. And I found that I used 90% dry flies. Didn't use a streamer at all. The young kids throw streamers because they're a very aggressive brown trout.
Yeah.
I just, from a guiding standpoint, it was much more fun to catch fish on the surface. This is probably the toughest river in America. Mike Lawson will tell you. All his guides come over. There are a whole bunch of guides that come and fish it because it's technically really difficult.
This is the Green?
The New Fork.
Oh, New Fork.
New Fork is another part of the Green.
Yeah.
New Fork is brushy and small. You have to fish it from a boat sitting down. Incredible guide skill. Most people, once the high water goes, they go. And the low water, I could draw you a map. I started fishing it in 1962, and I've never missed a year.
Oh, wow.
So I pretty much know it. Huh. I was able to secure 3.5 miles of public fishing with a relationship with the fly fishing governor. That's fly fishing politics. And it's where my heart and soul lives. And I didn't fish but a couple times a year. I fish more than anybody should. I got paid to fish on TV programs in New Zealand, and Australia and Argentina and Chile and Africa. You know, Courier's living what I already did.
Yeah.
But he's going to go to places I wouldn't go.
Probably a few more species under his belt, right?
Yeah. Well, he deserves all of it. He's a very bright, great artist. He is the epitome of a person that doesn't have kids.
Yeah.
And devoted a life. He's a very smart businessman. And he's devoted a life. He kept his day job to build up his career. When I sold out of the store, he left.
Yep.
As did all but Scott Sanchez, who now runs the store. A company from Chicago bought it, a group of guys, all really good guys, and they own it now. And Scott runs it. But the rest of them all went out. You know, it was really the thing is everybody went different places. Some went to Umpqua. Some ran, one of them ran a company for Columbia. They all went in great directions and all ended up with really good jobs.
Yeah.
And so I feel good about that.
Yeah.
But as to fishing, I do like the dry fly now. I'm 74, will be 74 in September, and I plan on doing a lot of fishing here in North Carolina. And I like all kinds of fishing. But, you know, there's something special about the dry fly if you can do it. If you're going to sit and look at a dry fly all day long, you may definitely. And I love using nymphs underneath the dry. But to match the hatch, not as a searching thing.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Turtlebox is the loudest, truly portable, waterproof Bluetooth speaker available. Perfect for a skiff, drift boat, or your craft of choice. The guys at Turtlebox believe in respecting the peace and beauty while on the water, but listening to great tunes before or after can be amazing. I remember our last big river trip this summer, and it was cool to break out the Bluetooth speaker as we listened to some classic music and tried to play along with our guitars. Without a Bluetooth speaker, we would have missed a bunch of amazing opportunities and some good laughs. The features I love most on this one are the quality bulletproof frame, easy to push and lighted buttons, and at home you can add another speaker for stereo. To be honest, I've been using this speaker quite a bit around the home, and the dance party with the kids has been great. Find out why TurtleBox is our go-to speaker and why it is great for the river as well. Head over to wetflyswing.com/turtlebox to support a great company, this podcast, and some tunes.
And now, back to our show.
Jack, as we start to kind of wrap this thing up out of here, just wanted to touch, I had one note here. Obviously the river runs through it. Gary Borger, we talked a little bit about that. I've had a few people that have been connected to it, but I know you were there early on and stuff like that, but I really want to just touch on Norman McLean because he obviously wrote the book. And you knew Norman? Can you talk a little about him and maybe, your take on, what type of person he was like?
Yeah. Well, my first encounter with Norman, when I was 32, I was appointed to a travel commission that was made up of state, federal, and businessmen for five states. And one of the representatives from Montana who ran the Montana Fish and Game was a woman from Helena. And we happened to have, we always would move to different places to have our meetings, and we were doing it in Helena. And he says, look, I got a guy that just wrote a book that has a fishing story, and I'd like, would you like to have dinner with him that night? And I said, sure. And it was Norman McLean. And he handed me this book. It was a hardbound book. He said, there's three stories or four stories in it. And he said, oh, it's only a four-hour read. I'd like to get your opinion about it. And so I said, sure. It was a weekend meeting. We actually had 3 days and then we left. And so I said, look, I'll read it. And he says, let's plan on breakfast on Monday. That was a Friday night. I read it and I'm, oh my God.
Yeah.
So we had the breakfast, Norman and, of all things, the gal's name was Norma. So, it was all that problem. Like Norman. Oh yeah. No. And he sat there, legs crossed, white hair.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, tell me about the book. And he was glaring at me. And I said, it's the greatest fly fishing story ever told.
Wow.
And I handed the book back. I mean, he didn't give it to me. And he picks up the book and throws it at me. Honestly. And Norma was like, Norman, now come on. But he doesn't get it. How come fly fishermen don't get it? And Norma looked at me and said, Norman, tell him what he's supposed to get. It is not a fly fishing story. It's a story about me trying to understand my brother through fly fishing.
Yep.
How did I get this to those people to understand this? And I said, well, Norman, you shouldn't have wrote so many beautiful lines. And then we talked about, my grandfather always said fly fishing was a religion. And he always said that Christ's disciples were fly fishermen. He didn't say anything else until I read Paul saying, Norman saying Paul was a dry fly fisherman, Christ's favorite. And being Catholic, I knew that right off the bat. And then, it was kind of interesting. He settled back down. And he said, look, when's your plane? I said, it's 5 o'clock. He said, we're going to go drive around. And I don't even remember what the vehicle was, but it was nothing fancy. What you'd expect somebody living like a hermit in the mountains would have. And he drove around and we talked and got to see the river and explained to me the book. And I said, Norman, you ought to get a movie made out of this. He said, I don't want to. Damn, we can't really say his language. He was cantankerous.
Yeah.
So when I went back, he took me to the airport and he says, can I call you? I'd love talking to you. And so we kind of had conversations. When I'd go up, that time I had a contract with Dan Bailey to help them in their fly operation. And it was very lucrative. Dan Bailey had actually sold me the first tackle for my fly shop and financed it for me. So I had a deep love for Dan Bailey. And so I'd go up there, and then I'd come back, and Norman loved Dan Bailey. He was his hero. And he just couldn't figure a way of getting Dan Bailey in the story, because Dan Bailey wasn't then yet. There. He didn't come until the late, I think, early 40s. And he said, let's keep in touch. And so I just had a loose, and I don't know how many people really had a close friendship. I know at that particular time, he was kind of estranged. His wife had died, and he was always blaming the wife and died, and the kids don't understand. And I have a feeling that kids have a tough time understanding their parents, especially when they're dynamic and they're good at something and they go off in a different direction. There's no way I would want anybody to do what I did in my family. I worked so darn hard, and they all did things that were helpful to mankind. And so Norman, I end up making meeting another influential part of my life, and that was Dr. Close, Bill Close. Now, that wouldn't mean anything to you, but he was the man who discovered the Ebola virus, a medical doctor from Connecticut. And he got involved with the overthrow of the Belgian Congo, quite a story in itself. And then came back to the U.S. and decided to locate in Big Piney, Wyoming. And they had money. His wife came from a good family, and Bill became just a country practitioner. And my wife, being the ER nurse, we ended up becoming friends, and I would take him fishing, and we'd go fishing. And this year, I went over to the pool. This one pool, we call it the Gowdy Pool, because Kurt Gowdy always loved to fish it. And in 1982, he told me about what happened this last year, what was going to happen, the pandemic. In fact, everybody on Earth, but he said it would come from a jungle, not from China. This is 1982. So anyway, at that time, I started telling him about the River Runs Through It. So he got the book. He loved it. He called his daughter, who happened to be Glenn Close, the actress. And she and William Hurt, who had my book, Who Tied Flies, when he did a show on Broadway, I arranged for them to go up and meet Norman. And they went out, and Glenn is just a magnificent personality. Bill's kind of laid back, you'd think of him as the ultimate college professor. And he says, look, I'll do it, but I have to be dad. So I can... And then he says, by the way, do you guys have, there's a warden coming. Do you have a license? They didn't get a license, and the warden cited him.
Oh, wow.
That was the end of that. So, you know, we kind of kept on. I lost kind of track of Norman. And I had been involved in getting a film commission in Wyoming that brought in movies. And the travel, remember, Wyoming's only 570,000 people. Yeah. If you're in any kind of business, you know the governors, you know the people. I've known all of them. And fly fishing, I mean, there's not that many well-known fly fishermen at that time from Jackson. From Wyoming. Huh. Gowdy and me.
All right.
So you got to know, and I did things for the travel commission. And all that. So we worked, and I brought some, because of my Hollywood friends, some movies to Jackson, which were really good for the state. So the state had sent Redford's people to come talk to me. Jackson has all the facilities. Robert Redford lives in Park City. He felt comfortable with Jackson. And I said, it's not the story. The story's Montana. And he said, well, would you be involved as a consultant? I says, man, I'm consulting New Zealand. I'm doing sports shows. I'm running a business. No.
Yep.
I know how movies are done. They were done in Jackson. It's a long commitment. And I said, but I'll tell you how to make this work. You call John Bailey, and you have Redford go talk to him. And that was the secret. But why it got done the way it was done. Mm. You ask Gary Berger, Cass, Jerry Seem did another guy you wouldn't maybe know, he's did all the shadow casting in spite of what anybody told you.
Oh.
He was the chief rod designer for Sage. Lived in Twin Bridges, Montana. He knew the story and fished the rivers. But there were other guys that, you know, it takes so much to do a movie. If you want to be bored out of your mind, go to a movie set. It'll take all day to get maybe 1 minute of film.
Right.
It's the most boring thing I'd ever do.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, Jackie, I mean, basically you turned down the greatest fly fishing movie of all time, right? Not turned it down, but you.
Well, I got a invitation and they called me and I don't remember back then. I recommended a lot of things. I recommended a mechanical trout. I recommended things and, you know, help them out a little. But once they got Borger, and he's a smart guy, and they got Deitch, who was a young guy. Young guys are good. You want young guys because they see things a little different than older guys. And Redford was, oh, gosh, he had to be in his late 60s.
Oh, he was.
You know, maybe his early 60s.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a role for him.
No.
And John actually talked him into being the narrator.
Oh, right.
Norman and it just wouldn't fit. Norman was young and the guy really looked like a young Norman. And then, of course, Brad Pitt played the other one. And I got to know the preacher. The guy was on Top Gun. He was in The One Fly.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Brokaw and him in The One Fly for our 25th anniversary. And he was a beautiful fly fisherman. He was on the American Rivers board.
Oh, cool.
And he was a steelhead fisherman. And so he had wow. So he didn't have any problem with talking about fishing, which was pretty cool. They got him not knowing that he was a fly fisherman. And of course, Redford's a big fly fisherman.
Yeah. For any of the youngsters listening now, I mean, obviously it's powerful, like we said, because of the family thing. I mean, I think most people have had some family issues. I've had some family issues around alcohol and.
Oh boy.
You know what I mean? Like the impact.
That is a common problem.
Yeah. 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 I know. I've had the same thing. I mean, I have a brother, I've got a few brothers, but I had one that, I mean, literally almost died, you know, and. So you feel it, man, because it comes down and you're like, you want to step in and be like, okay, I'm taking over this situation, but you can't. At a certain point, it's their lives. And
well, let me tell you a story. I met a guy named Dave who was a drummer for Waylon Jennings when he was 19.
Oh, nice.
And he got Waylon Jennings' daughter pregnant. And Waylon booted him out of the band.
Jeez.
Never married her, but they had the boy. And he went off and became a veterinarian and raised guard dogs, which meant he was selling them to the cartel.
Oh, wow.
Got himself in alcohol, drug problems, went to as low as you can where the FBI has you. And it was the lowest form you could ever go. Turned around, got off, got the sponsor, ended up becoming wealthy, had given his money. He'd married a second time, a real wealthy gal, didn't take any of her money, but gave her brother-in-law a little bit of money he had, and he ended up having enough to live the rest of his life. He dedicated his life in Park City to helping people with drug and alcohol problems. Fabulous guy. Musician, beautiful fly caster. He had now just bought a place in Hamilton on the Bitterroot River. He said, and I was dealing with three close friends, one a physician who had been arrested for reckless driving with a minor, the most respected doctor. And I was to the side of it, so how can I do this? And he said, you don't. You got to go to the lowest form where you're nothing else left. You either die or you decide to change your life. Nobody can do it for you. You have to do it. And I finally been able to be comfortable to realize that some of my friends, like, and I'll give you a prime example, is Robert Traver,
Oh, yeah.
John Volker was a terrible alcoholic. He was head of the, he rose to head of the Supreme Court. He wrote Anatomy of a Murder. And I asked him, how does it feel to have Jimmy Stewart play you? Here's his answer. Jimmy Stewart played me better than I played me.
That's
the
great.
I was a hopeless drunk, ran my friends off, and now I'm going to die alone.
Wow.
We went into the bookstore to Barnes & Noble. Talk about losing where you're known. So I've been around people that were hugely famous, and then they weren't. And it's hard to get a grip on that. He went in Barnes & Noble, and he wanted to give me a book. And he said, do you have Anatomy of Murder? No, don't know that. No, don't have it. Oh, what do you have from me? He says, who are you? Oh, my author name is Robert Traver. Oh, yeah, we got one paperback book. So he bought that and signed it. And, it, you know, you see, 3 months later, he died.
Oh, wow.
And so I've had a few of these come to Jesus moments on, you know, watching people.
For you, I'm not sure what your vice. Do you have any vices? I mean, I'm not sure.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Well, what's the vice that you has been
well,
a tough vice for you?
I had a disease called sarcoid, and then I had the heart thing. So alcohol doesn't sit well for that.
Oh yeah.
But I would say the vices is I can't stop talking.
Yeah, you're good at talking.
And I can't hear. But my vice is just not paying attention. And my vice is also is, as I've been married, I'll be 50 years, but I have to say I really like women. Like to talk to them. And I eat too much.
Yeah.
But I'm not fat.
They're
but
not
I,
fat.
I get criticized for that. I have a lot of, I don't false cast very much, if at all. This is drying a fly. I like to drive on long 12-hour drives just to see if I can do it. Yeah, I got a lot of vices, but it doesn't, never got into drugs, but there was a period where I could see having operations, how you could get addicted to oxycodone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time.
I never, ever had more than one, and that was just enough.
You know who I just heard? This is kind of crazy. I love podcasting. I listen to tons. I was just listening to Mark Maron, and you know who he had on was Hunter Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And Hunter Biden, I mean, we don't talk politics on here, but man, what a story. I mean, the guy, literally the president's son, is totally addicted to a crack, right? I mean— It's amazing to think that, wow, how do you, as Biden's son, become a crack addict? But he tells the story, and it's really a powerful story, the fact that just drugs and alcohol, man. I mean, a lot of people get caught up in that, right? I mean, it's a hard thing once you get in it to get out of it.
What the problem happens is they can't deal with life the way it is.
Yeah.
And they've learned to deal with it when they're in the alcohol stage. I have known people that you would know that all their whole life went from being alcoholics all the way to the time they die, yet they functioned as doctors, as writers, whatever.
Yeah.
And I never could quite understand the functioning alcoholic. But then you say, okay, you have asthma, you have to breathe the stuff, you have terminal diseases, you take drugs. We can't be... I think you still have to look at what the person accomplished. Like, what did the end deal? Yep. I've known some brilliant people. Look at the writings. Wow. I mean, it's so easy. I'll tell you, anybody's never had an oxycodone. And if you have one of those, I mean, you literally feel like the world can dish anything out to you.
Is it essentially cocaine, or right? Or is it?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think it's like an opiate. I think it's similar.
It's an opiate. But the thing is, you know, some people took like 20 of them. You know, the guy that died from Missouri. You know, what's his name? Trump gave him the Medal of Honor. He was the
political. Yeah, yeah. I can't remember. Yeah,
he was hopeless at one point. he was buying 20 a day.
Wow.
And so, I mean, he had to start with one and two. I never ever took, but I'd use a half of one. I had a broken neck when I was in 18. And about my late 40s, it started really bothering me. I thought that I was going to have surgery. Oh, no, just take one of these. Boy, I'll tell you, I had a permanent prescription, and I'd get like 50 for a whole year. And I'd take a half of one, and I needed it. And then I would keep them for emergencies. And I remember, and this lady got malaria. We're doing shows in Argentina and Chile, and she was desperate. And I gave her those. And several people that got hurt, I had them with me. And then, of course, the more you learned of it, the doctor and I said, these are too dangerous. He says, yeah, we know now you're off of them. But using anything responsible, I used responsible like alcohol, but I could see.
Oh, yeah.
I could see how very easy. And I'm allergic to, I have allergies, and I'm allergic to marijuana. So,
oh, wow.
I can't use, but I have to say, I do like margaritas when they let me have one.
Well, I'll tell you, I feel like our bodies let us know, sometimes, some people die. Well, a lot of people can die from it, but it sounds like your body kind of let you know, right? You've been through some stuff and it's, like marijuana, right? Yeah. I think your body probably.
Well, I had sarcoid, which is a disease. I was told when I was 31 that I had 4 months to live, diagnosed with a type of cancer. And it turned out to be a lymphatic disease, which went rampant through Jackson Hole, called sarcoid, Board sarcoidosis. They still don't know what causes it, but it attacks your lymph system. So it took 25 years before I got to a normal liver test. So that cut down the drinking.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed it. I mean, you just know. I mean, you'd have one drink and you couldn't drive.
Yeah. Right.
I was lucky, and all this. What I want to say is the best thing that could happen. What made my life worthwhile was I remember my daughter. We were taking her back to school. This is the one of the doctor at Shriners Hospital in Salt Lake. And she, we were walking to go on a flight somewhere. Back east to go back to school, and she said, Dad, what you do is really not that important, is it? And I said, no. I mean, he says, but it's you're well known. He said, why don't we live in we live in a wonderful house, but he said, why don't we have a mansion and all this stuff? I said, well, you're on television. Like, I only get like 500 a day, 1500 a day on television.
Yeah.
And no receptacle, just 1500 a day. Oh. And then all of a sudden, the guy stopped me. He said, you're Jack Dennis, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He says, your videos have helped me through the toughest time of my life, a divorce with my family.
Yeah.
And your videos kept me going. And my relationship with my kids are through fishing. I just want to thank you.
Yep.
And she says, I get it, Dad.
That's it. No, I think you hit it the nail on the head. We talked a little bit about the money, the fact that there's not a $1 billion company in fly fishing, but that's why we all do it. We all do it because we know that, the impact not only on us, but on other people from, and you've done a lot of it. Well, hey, I want to take us out of here really quick, I want to get it back to sports because,
obviously.
We didn't cover
hardly. Oh, the sports are, oof.
Yeah, that's right. Another addiction.
The guy's name invented the jump shot.
Oh, yeah. What was his name?
Kenny Sailors.
Oh, Kenny Sailors.
His brother was Bud Sailors. They had a dude ranch in Jackson. He was he went to Alaska. He died at 90. By the way, my father died at 90. My grandmother, 105. The other one, 100. That's why I've been able to get through all. I've got good genes.
That's right. And how old are you? How old are you now, Jack?
I'm 74. I believe 74 and 50.
Yeah. So you're still a young buck. That's right. I've interviewed a few people. Definitely. I mean, Frank Moore was, I think, 95. I interviewed Joe Humphreys, who's, I think, in it. I mean, those people, I'll tell you what, they don't sound like they're 90. They sound like they're, much younger. So I think there's another thing in fly fishing, right? It maybe keeps
you
younger.
Let me tell you a Joe Humphreys story. I've known Joe since I was 14 years old. His college roommate Charlie Ridenhour, they went to the Olympics together, and they were both coaches in wrestling at Penn State. He came out to Jackson and started working with me as a guide. And he brought out Charlie, and we fished when I was 14 years old, dry fly fished the Grovant River for one. At that time, we had rainbows and cutthroats in it. So I'm in Denver, and I always see Charlie. One time he called me. I was in the Boersburg End looking at his house, and he was in the store calling me. And my son was at Penn State. My son got PhD from Penn State. Jeez. But anyway, Joe, we're sitting there, and he always had his martinis, and you know, he was all by himself. And I'd just come off the show, and I said, Joe, yeah, sit down, Jack. And I said, and so we started to talk, and I had a dinner date, like you always do. You want to get as far away from those shows as you can. And he says, do you remember when we were casting to that rainbow under the tree? He says, that was so wonderful, Charlie, you and I. Excuse me, Joe? He's over 90.
Yeah.
I mean, over 80 then.
Oh, yeah.
He was 90 now. I mean, this was probably 5 years ago. And I thought, he says, you know, I've got some of those pictures. Like, how in the hell did he remember that?
That's awesome. Is it true? I gotta ask this because I think I had George Daniel mention this, but have you ever seen him smack around any of his students in fly fishing? You ever heard that story?
Who are you talking about?
Oh, No. So yeah, right. Bob Knight would be a good one. No, I heard George Daniel mentioned that. I think he was joking, but he said that, you know.
I coached George on the U.S. fly fishing
team. Oh, yeah. So gosh.
He still calls me coach.
That's right.
Even in his Twitter or his emails to me. Great story about George. The world fly fishing champion. Guy had won it 7 times. We're in Portugal, and George is fishing. And we're on a bridge, and he come up, and I know him. He speaks one of the few French that actually speaks pretty good English. He says, that's George Daniel, isn't it? And this is his first time on the team. He says, I want to tell you something. That's the best fly fisherman I have ever seen.
Yep.
Period. I mean, you don't get any better. This guy is the most famous fly fisherman in Europe. Yeah. And the French don't give those compliments out very easily. They had won more national world championships than any other country.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we've had.
And ask me about George, what you were going to ask.
No, I think I'm going to take, I'm going to leave that for the next one because George, we could go on a whole nother thing on George. He's obviously a great guy and everything. I did just want to take us out of
George,
here.
Which George are you talking about?
Oh, I was talking about George Daniel.
Okay.
I was talking about George Daniel because we had the and because I think he mentioned that Joe Humphreys used to smack him around when he wasn't doing what he needed to be doing fly fishing.
Have you ever been around? Have you watched Jim Jordan perform?
No.
In the Congress?
No.
Well, you need to do that.
Okay.
But he's a wrestling coach at Iowa or Ohio, and he's in the Congress. And you talk about smacking around. Wrestling coaches are notorious.
That's it.
So if George said it, probably happened.
Hey, I appreciate your time. Just before I get you out, one last one. Basketball, baseball, golf, you got these sports. You were a pro in fly fishing, but if you could have gone pro in one of those other sports, what would you have gone for?
Oh, absolutely would have been basketball.
What position?
Well, guard. I was 5'7". I played in high school. I played on a baseball scholarship because I was around Major League Baseball in college, and then I played for the Army. But I was not good enough. I could have maybe made rookie league, maybe I don't know. I just couldn't hit well enough.
Yeah.
But it was enough to get to 2 in the Army, play on the Army team at Fort Ord. That was good enough.
That's it.
But no, it absolutely, absolutely be basketball.
Love it.
I love, crave it. I'm 73. I still play.
Yeah.
I play. Every once in a while, I'll block a kid's shot, and I'll say, how does it feel to have a 70-year-old block your shot?
That's right.
So, yeah, I just love everything about basketball. I was always a point guard, which meant you control the action. And And, you know, being around and spent a lot of time with Danny Crum and Bobby, you know, it equates a lot to fishing. And, you know, who was one of the absolute best was the John Havlicek.
Oh, yeah.
Who was one of the best fly fishermen I've ever known.
That's right.
And I asked him this question, and we'll end it on this. I said, why did you quit at 41? Well, he was 41, 42, because he had the exact same scoring average as he did when he started. He says, well, Jack, I'll tell you. And by the way, he died about 3 or 4 months ago. And he said, you know, I'd get done with the basketball game, and I'd go in and turn the bathtub on the highest it would go. And I would get in the bathtub and for at least an hour before I could even walk. That's when I knew it was time to quit.
Hey, I just want to thank you again for coming on the show, Jack.
First-class production, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell anybody Jack Dennis recommends Dave Stewart.
Hey, I appreciate it. You know what?
You are a delight to be with.
You know what I love about this podcast thing is that I found the one thing that I really love as much as fly fishing is actually talking to people and doing the podcasting. So I think that's my superpower is the fact that I enjoy it a lot. So I appreciate your feedback there. And I'm looking forward to catching up with you and following everything else you got coming here.
All right, my friend.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes and all the links we covered, just go to wetflyswing.com/217. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/live. That's the best place if you want to check out our new live podcast where you can raise your hand, come up on stage and ask a question to a guest that we have on. So check it out. You can see when we have the next one scheduled there. That'd be awesome. Quick heads up to our next episode on Tuesday. Our next big Tuesday episode is with Al Q. Al Q is here to break down some striper fishing with a focus on California waters. That's pretty much it. That's a wrap. This has been awesome. I really enjoyed this one with Jack. Been wanting to get him on for a while. And so just kept my eye on it and finally made a connection. So hope you enjoyed it today. Hope you loved as much as I did. And hope to maybe catch you soon. Maybe see you online or maybe catch you on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.